Thank you, Laura. This is Dave Hammack at the Valdez Civic Center. The TV lights are on. The camera crews from, I think, ABC and CBS are here set up in the ballroom A and B of the Valdez Civic Center, and we're expecting in moments for the official press conference to start. However, until while they are getting the last few lights set up and people are filing in, we'll take a moment. Mayor John Devens is with me. John, I understand the City Council just had a special meeting called to deal with this situation. Would you care to share with us what the outcome of that meeting was?
Sure, I'd be happy to. We met this evening to determine whether or not we could appropriate some of the funding from the Zone 3 to take care of any of the problems that the city might encounter. And we did budget $1 million of the money that's in the Zone 3 account and actually appropriated $100,000 of that for a pit for the storage of absorbent materials.
The situation has been difficult to ascertain during the course of the day. We've had statements from various agencies, but very little input or feedback from people who have actually seen the situation. Were there any late reports given to the council at the meeting they just had?
No, actually, there was quite a few questions. We had quite a number of people in the audience, all frustrated because of lack of knowledge, feeling as though the city was not included in some of the decision-making processes enough. And that was actually something that was echoed by the members of the City Council. We're hoping to get one of our city administrators involved in the EOC and be involved in some of the decision-making since this is impacting the city.
EOC is the Emergency Operations Center?
Yes, that's correct.
Just recently, we, of course, have had two oil spill incidents within the port itself. Plus, in the last 6 months, there's been a major emergency response drill done by LASCA in which there were procedures for community involvement, information, and whatnot. Is your observation at this point that those drill procedures are being followed, or when the real thing came, did everybody run around in circles?
You know, I don't really know enough to make an honest comment on it. I know there were lots of concerns expressed about why 16 hours after the event took place didn't we have booms out there, but I really don't know enough to know whether or not they did what they should have done or didn't.
Has the, I know the governor's in town, has he had a chance to meet with city government officials to this point?
Bob Keller and I met with the governor for probably 20 minutes or so this afternoon when he came in. He wasn't here very long and then went immediately out to the site and has been out there since or gone home, I don't know which.
I understand he's still in town and holding a press conference at the airport before he leaves, so we'll all scramble from here out to there. You're listening to KCHU Radio. I'm Dave Hammack. I'm at the Valdez Civic Center. There is a special press conference been called here, I suppose called by Exxon, the company that owns both the tanker and the oil that is involved in the spill incident in Prince William Sound. At this hour, no fresh news on what is happening at the site itself. We hope to have an explanation of the current status as well as perhaps some discussion of how this all came to happen in a few minutes when the press conference is underway. I understand the president of Exxon Shipping is supposed to be here for this.
Yes, that is correct. He should be in town right now.
All right, well, Mayor John Devens, thank you for taking a moment and talking with us. We'll go back to the studio in just a moment. We'll be standing by here until the event does start. Again, we're expecting representatives from Exxon, the owner of the Exxon Valdez and the oil involved in the spill. And there'll be questions from both local and statewide and national press members who are here. We're going to find out how good the audio lash-up is here, whether we hear the questions. We'll certainly hear the answers, and that'll all be starting here pretty quick. Now, for the time being, this is Dave Hammack signing off at the Civic Center. Back to you, Laura.
Exxon, I wish to express our regrets for the any anxiety or inconvenience caused as a result of the grounding of Exxon Valdez. I want to also assure all of you that Exxon is mobilizing all of the resources available to mitigate the impact from this incident. And I'll talk a little bit about what is going on and how we plan to approach this in a minute. I also want to clearly state that Exxon has assumed full financial responsibility for the cleanup or anything that needs to go on. And as soon as we can get our response team operational, we plan also to assume operational responsibility for the salvage and cleanup. Thanks to the very rapid response of the U.S. Coast Guard, the Department of Environmental Conservation, and Alyeska's response teams, I think the first steps in corralling or controlling this incident have already been initiated. And I'd like to thank those agencies for moving as quickly as they did. Right now we have two very important objectives, and the first one is to move aggressively to collect or disperse the oil that is on the water. And time is critical, so we're moving very quickly to get the resources in place to undertake that activity. At the same time, we're moving cautiously to remove the oil from the damaged vessel and to salvage the vessel. Safety is paramount in this particular regard. We need to move cautiously and carefully because the last thing in the world we want is any more oil on the water. So we need to move aggressively to attack the oil that is on the water, and we need to move cautiously and carefully to get the rest of the oil off of the damaged ship. And I'll be talking about that also. Once we have eliminated the danger to the environment and to the vessel, then we will need to reconstruct the events that led up to the incident so we can understand exactly what went on and why the vessel grounded. I'm sure all of you have those questions too. We'll be initiating our own investigation, and I'm sure the Coast Guard will be initiating its investigation. The current condition of the vessel, as far as we know, let me just step back and say the vessel is a 211,000-ton tanker. It's a U.S. flag tanker with a U.S. crew. Its construction was completed in December of 1986. It is therefore one of the newest vessels in the U.S. tanker fleet. For the past 2 years since her delivery, she has been in Valdez service. The master is Captain Joseph Hazelwood. He's a veteran with 20 years' experience in the Exxon fleet. He's been a master for over 10 years, and he's been the master of Exxon Valdez for the past 20 months. He also has unlimited pilotage qualification for Prince William Sound. The vessel is still aground on Bligh Reef, and we just came in from Houston and got an opportunity to fly over the vessel. As far as we know, five cargo tanks are clearly damaged, damaged during grounding. There is some reason to believe that perhaps three other cargo tanks are damaged. The vessel itself is fully operational. She has full power available. All of her systems are operational. She has full steering control. An estimated 200,000 barrels of crude oil escaped from the vessel. Most of it escaped at the time of the grounding or shortly after the grounding. The oil slick now covers approximately 6 square miles, and we flew over that also. It's drifting southward slowly in Prince William Sound, and they understand that some oil has been detected ashore. Alyeska has three skimming boats and two tank barges in operation collecting oil from the slick. There are three tugs assisting the vessel. We have one tanker in the vicinity. It's the Exxon Baton Rouge, which is a 75,000-ton tanker. Our plan is to move the Baton Rouge alongside the Valdez once we are sure that we understand the condition of the damaged vessel. And are confident, once we are confident that we can do that, we will move the Baton Rouge alongside and begin to lighter the cargo from the damaged vessel onto the Baton Rouge. A Baton Rouge can take about 450,000 barrels, or about half the remaining oil on the ship. The Exxon San Francisco, also a 75,000 tonner, will be arriving at sunrise tomorrow. And our plan would be to lighter the remaining cargo from the damaged vessel onto the Exxon San Francisco. We also have had offers from ARCO, from Chevron, and from BP. All of them have vessels in the vicinity, and they are all more than anxious to help us lighter the cargo off of the vessel. The nucleus of the response team arrived just within the past hour. Six of us came in from Houston and three from San Francisco. Together, these nine people will essentially manage the casualty response efforts. We also have a group of 20 members of Exxon's response team on the way, and they'll be coming in later tonight and early this morning. Altogether, we have 20 members of this response team. That's in addition to the nine that are already here. And these 20 people are trained in different aspects of casualty response, and they will essentially be the supervisors of different activities that are going on. They are well trained. They all know what they have to do. In fact, their last training exercise was a two-day training exercise in October of 1988. So these folks are well qualified for what they need to do. We are also assembling about three-quarters of the world's experts on oil spill cleanup. Mr. Gordon Lindblom came up with us from Houston. He's an expert on dispersant application. Mr. Jim O'Brien is on his way here. He's an expert on mechanical cleanup. He's the gentleman, incidentally, who took over the cleanup of the Glacier Bay. He also recently was in Antarctica helping with the cleanup from that vessel that ran aground in Antarctica. Mr. Al Allen is also joining our group. He is an expert on Alaskan oil spill cleanup, and he will be part of the team. Coming in from San Francisco is Mr. Jim Rivera. He's bringing two assistants with him. He heads the Clean Bay Cooperative in San Francisco, and he's bringing his equipment with him. Mr. Brent Pyburn is coming in from London. He's bringing four of his assistants with him. And he is a representative of the Oil Spill Response Limited group there. Also, Alice Berkner has been asked to join the group, and she is with International Bird Rescue Center in case we need that. The cleanup crew members are being assembled. Our first available people are the Alaska off-shift people, and we hope to have 50 to 60 members from that group, and I understand they have had recent experience here at the terminal. We also have 40 members of cleanup crews coming over from Kenai, and we anticipate that we'll be able to mobilize another 150 if we need it, and we're in the process of getting in touch with those people. So altogether, we have about 40 managers, supervisors, and experts from all over the U.S. and also from the United Kingdom. We have about 100 members available to form cleanup crews, and we're hoping to mobilize another 150 if needed. We also have set up a claims management team, and we have an Exxon claims coordinator on the scene. He came up from Houston with us, and we all have also enlisted the help of Crawford and Company to handle any claims resulting from the incident. Let me talk about equipment, and we're mobilizing a lot of it. We have a DC-8 cargo jet coming in from San Francisco. It is either going to arrive, maybe here now, but it was due in late this afternoon or early evening. It is carrying the Clean Bay equipment, which is one ocean oil skimming system and a whole system of emergency communications, because as we get this operation going, we're going to need to keep in touch with all the different parties. We also have a C-130 dispersant spray plane, which is coming in from Florida. It should arrive. Its last ETA we heard was 6 o'clock in the morning. We also have a 707 cargo jet coming in from London. That's bringing the equipment that Mr. Pyburn and his assistants will need. They have 4 oil skimming units that will be coming in on this plane, including portable oil containment tanks. And that plane is due to arrive in Saturday morning. We have a second C-130 spray plane coming in from Houston, and we expect that to be here late Saturday. We have a 707 cargo jet coming in from Houston. It's loading the second supply of dispersant. There is about 400 drums of dispersant available to us between Anchorage and here in Alaska. That'll be our first supply, and then we'll need to be resupplying from Houston, and this 707 will be shuttling back and forth. We have another cargo aircraft, I don't know the type, it's coming in from Seattle, and it's bringing 2,500 feet of boom. Also, there's some boom coming in from Kenai. That plane is due to arrive late Saturday morning. So altogether, we've got at least 6 aircraft en route with different types of skimming equipment and also dispersants. In addition, we have all of the equipment available to Alyeska. They have 3 oil skimming vessels, and we saw those vessels out in the Prince William Sound. We have the 2 Exxon vessels available, and we also have a number of vessels that have been offered into us to assist from ARCO, Chevron, and BP. Our plan at this point will be to begin the lightering operations once we are convinced that we can do that safely. And our concern is for the damaged condition of these Aldis. We have to make sure that that vessel is up to this type of operation and we can remove the cargo safely. So we're going to do that very carefully, but the Baton Rouge is in place, and the San Francisco will be coming in. The Exxon San Francisco will be coming in first thing tomorrow morning to form a backup. We would like to be able to lighter all of the cargo off the vessel. When we're about halfway through that operation, the vessel will float free. We'll then try to continue the lightering in place, moving it to a safer position. We're right now developing alternatives to handle the oil that is on the water. It looked to us like it is spreading as it moves south, so we're going to need to move very quickly. And our first alternative will be to apply chemical dispersant to it starting in the morning. And we'll be moving to a full-scale operation once we determine the effectiveness of that first application. So just recapping, those of us in this business understand that once in a great while this happens to us. We look back in the records, and the previous spill to any time this month for an Exxon ship goes all the way back to 1972. When we lost about 1,000 barrels from a vessel in Connecticut. So for the past 17 years, we haven't had an incident like this, and unfortunately, this is the second one we've handled this month. So we had 17 good years, but this has not been our best month. We are moving very, very quickly to get all the resources in place, and hopefully by first thing tomorrow morning we'll be in full operation. Okay, at this point I'm ready to address questions.
This is KCHU Valdez. We're broadcasting live from the Valdez Civic Center. You've been listening to Jack Rossi, president of the Exxon Shipping Company. We won't be able to hear the questions from the press. We'll be able to hear the responses, and we hope they'll recap the answers. Here's Jack Rossi.
And we've had very sketchy communications. So, and I haven't had time. I just dropped my bag, shaved my whiskers, and came over here. So it could be $300,000. I couldn't. Yes.
What position
to
maintain this ship is way off the channel? Is there any place to fly so far?
We, at this stage, really don't understand the sequence of events. What we know is that the vessel proceeding out of the channel ahead of ours requested permission that was granted to move out of the outbound lane across the separation into the inbound lane in order to avoid some heavy ice that was on the blocking the outboard lane. We also understand our ship did the same thing and was granted permission to move over to the far edge of the vessel traffic lane. But the circumstances that transpired from that point to the grounding, we really do not understand ourselves. We have all the same questions you do. And we'll certainly be moving at the appropriate time to dig into all those questions. Right now, we are moving with almost single-mindedness to get that lightering operation going so that we can get the oil off. And then, secondly, to begin to address the oil that is on the water. When we get through all of that, and that's going to absorb all of our resource and energy for a short period of time here, when we get through with that, then we clearly are going to have to dig in and will dig into all of the circumstances leading up to the incident. Yes?
My name is Ricky
Ott. Yes, Ricky.
United Fishermen of Alaska and the local fishing group, Fidelity District Fishing United. I'm sorry this had to be your vote, but we were expecting something like this. At this point, I've been expressed a lot of concerns about it at once.
Yes, certainly we all have concerns.
The first is, we were flying at 9 o'clock this morning. I believe we were the first plane up.
Ricky Ott of the Cordova Fisheries CDFU is now addressing some questions to Jack Rossi. And it's difficult to hear the questions. We will hear the responses. She's asking a question about 9 o'clock this morning. The first flyover was apparently by CDFU, and she's asking why there was no response evident at the time about 9 o'clock this morning.
It shouldn't have been spilled in the world clean up. It happened inside the waters. There was no weather. It's flat calm. There's no wind. Also, the proximity to the tanker terminal in Alaska where the booming equipment was available, this boat should have been boomed immediately, or something should have been done immediately to contain the oil. At 12:30 when we were out up in the air again, I was amazed to see that the boat was filled.
Well, the question is taking on more of the aspect of a statement. Ricky is asking why there was no effort evident at 9 o'clock on the first flyover or at 12:30 on a subsequent flyover. At 12:20, KCHU had one of its volunteers in an aircraft on the flyover, and at that time we also noted that at 12:30, approximately 12 hours after the incident did occur, there had been no evident effort toward booming the tanker or beginning a containment effort. Again, that question is being addressed in great detail to Jack Rossi by Ricky Ott of CDFU at this time. Again, this is a quick put-together on the audio, and we certainly apologize for not being able to carry these questions. We'll do our best to relay to you the gist of the question. We will be able to hear the response from Jack Rossi.
What emanated from the tanker, and then what emanated from this pumping of the Baton Rouge? So far, we've got two things. We've got... Why hasn't any action been taken already? I mean, 9 hours after the spill, that's a long time.
All right, the first question I really can't address. I got here a half hour ago. I don't know if there's anybody in the room who can.
We need a name. I can get this from you later, but the fisherman would like to refer to being here on officer's something that could be included in all the meetings from now on, but you have my input. One more major point in that this person's, as far as I know, not to be used in this area. I mean, they have to go through an on-scene coordinator.
Yes, all that's been done. This is a Zone 1 area. And that means that it's been predetermined that the decision-making process to use or not use dispersants rests with the Coast Guard.
However,
yeah, there's a lot of, there must be 10 or 15 years of history in the use of dispersants, a lot of work that's been done with the Environmental Protection Agency, with the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation. And certain areas are prejudged to be safe for dispersants, and that authority rests usually with the local Coast Guard to make that decision. Other zones where it's more sensitive, then that judgment passes to others, higher authority. I don't know the particular circumstances here.
Dispersants are also most effective if they're used within 24 hours. They're very effective if they're used within 12 hours.
Yeah, I'm not the dispersants expert. We do have one with us. He told me, wait just a minute. His advice was that the dispersants wouldn't be effective immediately after the spill because the layer was too thick. You actually have to get some spreading, and you have to get, and again, I'm not talking as an expert, but you have to get some spreading, and you have to get a layer that's thin enough to be most effective. I think we got a great window tomorrow morning, and that's when we'll be working it.
There was, we could see the haze on the water of the hydrocarbons evaporating, the volatile hydrocarbons, which means that this stuff is rapidly turning into a very patty cake-like consistency stuff, which on which the dispersants will not be effective at all.
Well, I don't think we can prejudge that.
Have you been taking examples prior to dispersant use?
I think the most effective will be a test. And when we run our first run tomorrow, then we'll be able to tell. I don't think anybody can prejudge at this point whether it's going to be effective or not.
So you can try a little patch first.
Yes. Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Fact was that it was about, 12, 14 hours before anybody saw anything out there that even remotely resembled a sort of containment measure. I'm Larry Campbell. I'm with the Anchorage Daily News. There is a question, and a lot of people have asked this, about why something more wasn't done earlier, why there wasn't somewhat more containment measures being undertaken at an earlier stage in time. How do you feel about it?
Well, the information I have, just let me go back to what I do know. The grounding occurred at 0038, which was about, let's call it, 3:40 Houston time. And I was awoken at about 4:20 with a call from Alyeska. So they were immediately mobilizing. And we started working from there in Houston. And by about 6:30, Houston time, we were going full out. We had, as you can imagine, pulling all these planes and equipment in the air didn't just happen. And we were mobilizing by 6:30 in the morning, everything we can get our hands on. That's Houston time. So that would be about by 3:30 in the morning your time, or roughly 3 hours after the event. I don't know what activities were going on here, but I do know from the numerous conversations I had with George Nelson and also with the other Alyeska people. I mean, they were up and moving fast. I was in Houston.
Well, are you satisfied with what they've done up to the point that you got here?
I really have to dig in and find out exactly what was going on and what were the circumstances.
Well, right now, can you say, are you satisfied or do you still have questions?
I have a lot of questions.
The question is, as quickly as you were able to move this morning, as much as you did, is there another place here where we have to fly equipment from London and San Francisco in areas that are busy like this?
Well, you know, it's not uncommon. I tell you, we had two spills in a matter of 3 weeks. The one previous was just about 3 weeks ago in Hawaii, and we did exactly the same thing. We had the same planes in the air. We were moving the same equipment. It's just a fact that the way the oil response system worldwide goes, there's a number of stockpiles. And what you really have to do is stockpile that equipment alongside a major airport, and a major airport that has a lot of traffic and a lot of cargo planes. Because while you could buy equipment and put it in a storehouse, you can't buy 707s and DC-8s and leave them there. So you got to have immediate access to cargo jets. So you find out that the equipment is stored near London, near Houston, near San Francisco, so that wherever a spill occurs, you can load it in the plane and get it in the air. And it's all packaged very quickly, palletized, to be moved onto a plane. So I think the key factor in where the oil industry and the response industry centers its activity is really related to major airports, because you do need a good logistics system. Well, you know, the major shipping lane starts in Valdez, but it goes all the way down to Panama. So, you know, we're in that spot. I can understand your sensitivity since you're in this part of the shipping lane. I'm not saying I wouldn't be as sensitive as you are, except when you look at it, the shipping lane goes, you know, thousands of miles, and you need to be ready to respond up and down that coast.
Given the critical time of all this, again, why doesn't the oil industry stockpile this stuff right here in Valdez, and how long is the terminal been here?
I think there is a fair amount of equipment. There's a lot of dispersant. There are 400 barrels of dispersant available, 400 drums right here and now. What we've got to do is get the spray plane here. The spray plane is coming all the way from Florida. But we had the same situation with the Hawaii spill. So one of the key things is that Alyeska does have a major supply of dispersant here. And there's still plenty of time to hit the spill. You know, we flew over it coming in.
And,
we were at 3,000 feet, so we didn't see the sea lions.
Yes, sir. Yeah, I'd like to know, I didn't get your last name, what was it?
Hayarosa.
Yes, sir. I didn't hear you say anything about hire Alaska help. All I hear you say, you're going to send it all in. Now, what are you going to do here? This disaster happened in our water.
I'm sure we'll be looking for all available help to the extent.
What are you going to do about our herring out there? Did you come up with anything on that?
Well, I'm not an expert on herring, but certainly we're going to be very, very conscious of it.
Okay. That's what I want to know.
Yes, sir.
In response to some of the questions that response from Alyeska, there was people mobilized within, I'd say, an hour after the thing went aground here, as early as 1 o'clock in the morning. And they were on their way of doing a lot of preparatory work and things. But that brings to mind my question is, why haven't you and Alyeska made a permanent and storage area for such a collecting for oil spill emergencies? There hasn't been anything stockpiled here of any quantity that would take care of this major port. And it was inevitable that something of this magnitude would come about, and there should have been some stockpiling of this material.
I can understand your concern, but I think you're going to find that that airport out there is going to be inundated with equipment very soon. And that's the way that that response equipment is normally handled. So in just about any spill like this, you're going to have a period when you need to mobilize people. You need to mobilize the experts, and you need to get the equipment there. And I think in this case, we're going to have it all here in probably 24 hours or 30 hours. which still gives us plenty of time. We really haven't begun to dig into that. I think at this point, I wouldn't comment on any speculation. What we really need to do is go through a careful investigation. And
those were questions regarding why the tanker had strayed so far outside of the tanker lane.
Will certainly be known. Yes. IAROSSI. Just say all the vowels and you'll get it right. Yes.
Tell me this. What would be the normal procedure?
Say one of your ships goes out there, they dump 200,000 barrels of oil in the water. What's supposed to happen first? What's supposed to happen second, third, so on?
Well, there's two things that need to go on immediately. One is we need to begin to salvage the vessel, and that's very, very important because it still has a lot of oil on it, and normally it will. So you got to begin to worry. You have to limit the amount of oil that's spilled. That's a very, very important activity. You have a grounding. Some oil goes in the water. But normally you will find there's still a significant amount of oil on the ship. So one of your concerns right off the bat is to prevent any further oil from going in the water. That's number one. Number two, you've got to begin to mobilize all the resources to address the oil that is on the water. And those two things need to go on simultaneously. That's not a sequential event. You need to hit them both, and you need to hit them both hard. In the case of the vessel itself, you got to be a little more cautious. The oil on the water, time is critical, so you need to address that just as fast as you can. As far as the vessel goes, time may be critical depending upon the circumstances. The circumstance we have here, I don't think we should be rushing. I think we should be cautious. Because the vessel, as far as we can see and as far as we know, is not leaking any further oil. What happens when you have a bottom rupture like this ship does is a certain amount of oil leaks out until the level of the oil in the tank is equalized with the water level. And then you basically reach equilibrium and there's nothing further going on as far as oil, as long as you're not disturbing or moving the vessel. So we're in that period now where it will pay for us to be kind of cautious to make sure we have a good damage assessment of the vessel before we go into the lightering operation. But we will need to go into lightering. That's absolutely critical.
It would have done any good, say, at sunup this morning to have
I really can't comment on that. I know there is considerable boom available right here, so that if in fact that seemed to be a reasonable step to take, I'm sure it would have been taken, but I can't comment on what was going on.
What would make that decision?
Alyeska took first response steps. It's between Alyeska and the Coast Guard.
Between Alyeska and the Coast Guard?
Yes, but I think, as far as I know, Alyeska took the response coordination. But I can't swear that.
They would make that decision. They wouldn't have to ask.
They wouldn't need my permission, no. No.
If they wanted to leave the boat out there until we got here, that's their decision. They wouldn't have to ask.
I think it's between Alyeska and the Coast Guard. Certainly the Coast Guard has a responsibility to make sure that everything that should be done is in fact being done. And they will usually monitor the situation to make sure what they think is reasonably required is in fact going on.
So if you guys get here, it's the responsibility of Coast Guard and Alyeska.
Yes, until we have our response team fully here and ready to go operational, which I think will probably be first light in the morning. But as we stand right now, we're just beginning to get the team together. So as soon as we're ready, we will tell Alyeska and the Coast Guard we're ready to assume operational control. But until we get here, it rests between the Coast Guard and Alyeska. And I think the tendency is to allow, in this case, Alyeska, or whatever is the local cleanup activity, to take first response. And the Coast Guard will have to speak for itself, but I think they usually monitor. If they're not satisfied, then they will take it over.
One last question. Did I ask you to do a good job so far?
Boy, they sure got me out of bed in a hurry. And I assume that if they got me out of bed as quickly as they did, that they had an awful lot of people scrambling early.
So,
yes, as far as I know. I can't criticize anything I've done.
So you said that the vessel had 5 cargo tanks, clearly damaged, possibly 3 others. How many total cargo tanks?
The vessel has... she has a total of, 15 tanks, of which 4 are ballast. So she'll have 11 cargo tanks. Eleven cargo tanks that would have been filled at the time she came out. She wasn't actually fully loaded. She can carry 1.5 million barrels. In this trip, she had 1.26 million. The reason she was light was because she was going into San Francisco, so she had to go in with a lighter draft. Right now, the tanks we know that are fully intact are 3 of the cargo tanks and 2 of the ballast tanks. And, of course, the engine room is fully intact. So there should be sufficient buoyancy on the vessel as she stands right now. And, you know, there's a lot of tanks damaged, but don't forget, this ship was designed to be full of oil. So she will operate with the buoyancy that she still has available. We'll float.
We expect you're going to be able to get it off.
Yeah, the process we need to go through is we need to get somewhere around 300,000 barrels off the ship, and at that point the ship should float free. And we'll continue to pump oil off the ship until we've got the ship free of cargo. And we'll continue to lightering. So the first step, you know, as long as the vessel is on the reef, she is in a precarious position. So we clearly have to move to get the oil off that ship. We got to do it cautiously, but we got to do that.
You're saying that you're going to pump 300,000 barrels off, and then it'll float, and you can take it away, or you're going to get all the oil off before you...
We're going to start the lightering operation, and the vessel we'll be using has the capability of taking 450,000 barrels off. We think that by time the vessel has transferred about 300,000 barrels by our calculations, she should be light enough to float free. Now, at that point, it'll depend on the circumstances. We may want to interrupt the lightering to move the vessel and then continue the lightering. But it would be our plan to get all the oil lightered into the other two vessels before we begin to move that ship around.
How long do you expect it to take to get 300,000 barrels of oil off the vessel?
It should be, I'm guessing, about 10 hours, I think, to reach that once we start the lightering. But it depends upon what rates we actually get the pumping up to.
I also have to point out it depends on the weather. Weather for this time of year is very unusual.
Well, that's exactly why we need to take advantage of that calm weather to get the lightering operation going. Pardon? There's 50 feet of water to the port side of the vessel, and that's where we'll be doing the lightering and lightering into the 70,000 tonner, the 75,000 tonner. But 50 feet of water is clearly enough for us to move the 450,000 barrels. She's aground on the starboard side, And it's, from what I understand, it's kind of a ledge. And the pilots have done very careful sounding all around it. On the port side of the vessel, they have a clear 50 feet.
Sir?
Yes?
Nothing has been done so far. We're not required nearing the vessel. Fishing industry is a very important industry in this area, and nothing is being done to protect the area where everyone is very dangerous. We've been up since 6:30 this morning, Bob.
And there's a large number of boats that are ready to do whatever's necessary, and I'm sure with all this advanced technology, the creeks could be protected. And nothing's been done.
Well, clearly that will be one of our first activities of the shore in the oil spill containment group.
When did that start? We've been begging to go all day. That could have been done this morning without ever nearing the vessel.
I really can't comment on it. I was flying the whole time.
Who did we talk to? The Coast Guard?
Do you think three skimmers is enough to hit a terminal like this?
42-foot skimmers, they hold like 3,000 gallons, and they won't skim nothing. And that's what we got to guard in our port.
Well, that's why we need to move quickly on this person.
Well, we've been ready to go since this morning. Why isn't anything being done to protect the creeks? We've been calling and asking to go.
I can't answer.
I'd like to back.
Sure.
He said that slip was over 8 miles. You told us here it was 6 miles.
No, I said it covers 6 square miles. That's the latest.
6 square miles?
And yes.
What time did you go out?
Oh, we flew over it at about 5:30 this afternoon. I think the Coast Guard has come up with the 6 square miles. I can't measure 6 square miles from 3,000 feet. So I'm using somebody else's figures.
Has there been any plans yet for a bottom survey of the vessel?
Yes, we have divers out there right now.
Okay.
The dive.
Donnie, we're going to water construction on an anchorage. We were on the Saul incident out of Dutch Harbor. One of the first things we did was determine the extent of the damage to the bottom of the vessel. Probably should be, you are on it now.
I understand there's a diving group that when I was coming over here, it was on its way to the ship. So that's clearly one of the first things we want, and they'll be taking underwater videos, and we'll know a lot more when we get those.
Available here, right?
Okay, I'd like to talk to you.
How many more skimmers are available on the West Coast to get this thing started on skimming it now? You know, how many are available?
Two. Well, we are bringing in four from London and one skimming system from San Francisco. The way it's spreading, I don't think skimming is the answer, clearly. If we had...
protect our environment and get in front of the bay and the damage in the garden, in my opinion. To protect the environment, it's already out there. We need to protect the bay. Major bays need to skim.
I agree totally with you. And,
coordination.
You know, if you have a representative that would like to point out the most environmentally sensitive, we have a lot of that already pre-planned. Good. We'll be working with the state agency.
We're waiting to go to work. Get something going in the
time. Yes, sir.
Yes. On the cause of the accident, I know you can't comment, but what do you feel of reduced crew sizes and more fatigue on the people that run the ships? And secondly, did you receive a letter from a Mr. Spencer or a Mr. Hillman representing the Exxon Siemens Union within the last 2 weeks after the spill in Hawaii, suggesting that reduced crew sizes may cause accidents in the future?
I didn't receive any letter. There now is a government study going on. It's sponsored by the Coast Guard through the National Research Council, which is looking exactly into the question of the relationship between crew size and safety. That study is due to conclude about the end of the year with the full report coming out probably around the April 20th, or around April of next year. You know, the spill, it's hard to say. This vessel has a crew of 20. And as far as I can tell, there's no circumstance that would indicate the crew size had anything to do with it. If we had 80 people on air, that would be just 60 more we'd have to try to get off. You know, this the incident of this, of the casualty, as far as we can tell, is not related to crew size. There clearly was something went wrong. It was not with the operation of the vessel, mechanical operation, because she was fully operational at the time that she grounded. So we need to dig in and understand exactly what it was, but I can't see any connection with crew size. Yes.
Sir, is it your impression that the Coast Guard was monitoring the departure of this ship with sophisticated radar, and what happened?
I believe there is a VTS system for Valdez, and I know the vessel was in contact with the Coast Guard, because they have to ask for permission to depart from the outbound lane, and that was granted. So there was some communication going on between the Coast Guard and the vessel.
Was there any warning by the Coast Guard that the ship was so far outside of the lane?
I don't know. Don't know. But certainly we'll need to get into all that. Yes? Well, as far as we can tell, everything on the ship was operational. There was no rudder failure. There was no power failure. So I think we would need, when we get into it, we will need to address the actions in navigating the vessel, not... and certainly we'll look to all the equipment to make sure we understand its condition, but at this point, everything we, all the indications we have is that the vessel's fully operational. Yes, ma'am.
Mr. Hierathi, I'm afraid that you're generating more questions than you're answering.
That usually happens.
You mentioned that Exxon is assuming all financial responsibility for the spill, which I think is a very positive step. But I would also like to point out that after the majority of the spill is cleaned up off the water, and it looks like there's no more oil around, that the water can be the oil can be down in the water column, and the fisheries resources can still be affected weeks after the spill looks like it was cleaned up. Now, I am interested to know whether your company is going to cover our fisheries resources if, when the herring fishery opens, and our fishermen deliver to the local processors, and I'm assuming we're going to have a DEC person there, if the DEC person discovers that hydrocarbons have been stored in the lipid levels of the herring, which would be the herring roe, which is what we're trying to market at this time of year, hydrocarbons are collectively stored in lipids.
I said we would assume full financial responsibility. I didn't put any qualifications on it.
Okay, so there's...
If it's a claim that is associated with the spill, we've assumed full financial responsibility.
We're worried that not only that our creeks will be affected, but also the fisheries resources could potentially be affected weeks after it looks like the spill was.
Well, we would be just as concerned as you are, so we'll be talking a lot with you and making sure that that all the checks are necessary. We aren't going to be leaving for a long time.
Do you have any financial estimate of possibly the value of this incident at this point?
No. Having mobilized half the cargo planes in the world just 3 weeks ago, I can tell you that's an expensive piece of the activity. Yes, sir.
Could you outline your task force plan of attack as far as mobilizing and news releases and what you're going to do for the local people as far as employment and utilizing the facilities here locally?
The task group itself will be comprised of of these 40 people that I said, some of them you might call managing activities, others are supervisors of more specific activities, and then we've got six or eight scientific advisors who have different expertise. And they'll be handling different facets of it. One major activity that will be going on within that is any kind of beach cleanup or shoreside cleanup. And there are two people who will be managing that activity, and they will be calling on and attempting to mobilize whatever resource they need. And certainly we would look to you all to be right in the forefront of that. Still don't know. My guess is it'll be around 3 million plus or minus a million. Most of the cost, the biggest cost item in that that particular spill was mobilizing an awful lot of equipment. Very fortunately, we didn't need any of it. because the spill, rather than being at the magnitude we initially thought, turned out to be a total of 2,800 barrels. I'm sorry, 800 barrels. Total spill was 800 barrels. 600 it came from the cargo hose at the terminal, and 200 it came from the ship. And we initially thought the spill was at least 2,800. But after the assessment on the ship, that was downgraded to 800. And we had half the response equipment in the world mobilized for 800 barrels. And that probably was over one-third of the total cost, just getting the airplanes in the air, half of which we turned back before they got to Hawaii. But you know, in a situation like this, what you have to do is mobilize all the resource you can, because you have to make sure you're ready for any eventuality. And we're certainly not going to spare any cost in doing that. Yes, sir.
Valdez is notoriously difficult to fly in and out of. What are there any contingency plans in place if the weather comes in and we can't fly in or out of here for the next few days?
Well, we'll be getting most of the equipment in by tomorrow morning, so we need to be lucky for about 12 hours or so. The dispersants will the current plan, and it may change, the fellows are up there firming up these plans, but at least as I left and came here, our plan was to operate the dispersants out of Anchorage. So the dispersion activity will be coming out of Anchorage. Well, we have authority to test and to begin to use dispersants, and of course what you do is you address that with one application, and then you have to determine the effectiveness of it. There's no sense in spraying if it's not effective. Very, very moderate amount of turbulence. You do need some agitation, but not too much. Again, I'm not an expert on dispersants.
When do you think the dispersant test will occur, and how long after that
important when you're going to go? The plane is due in, and it has the dispersant equipment. It's a C-130, and it also has a load of dispersant. So NIT's due in about 6 o'clock in the morning. I think what we'll do is land it here in Valdez and get ourselves ready for the first application. We need to put a helicopter up in the air. The helicopter essentially directs the plane, and then the helicopter will be monitoring the effectiveness. So, you know, I'd say as fast as we can turn that plane around, maybe an hour or so, we have it in the air, and I'd say that, you know, by mid-morning we ought to know how effective it's going to be. Yes, sir.
Error that the ship is fully operational.
Can we assume then you are investigating human error and that is the most likely cause? What other cause could it be?
Well, I'd hesitate to really pinpoint it at this point. We need to go at it with a pretty open investigation which does not make any presumptions going in. I could say at this point we've had no indication of any mechanical or electronic failure, none whatsoever. But still, we'd have to go in. One of the first questions we need to ask is what equipment was operating? Was it operating normally? Then we need to understand the whole sequence of events. We understand that the vessel moved to the inboard lane to get around the ice, and we do understand that there was some maneuvering in ice. Also, during this process, they were letting the pilot off. And then it was a short time after that that the vessel grounded. But we're going to need to go through that very, very carefully, almost minute by minute. And there'll be a lot of interviewing and a lot of discussions that need to go on. And I suspect the Coast Guard has already started that itself. They had a Coast Guard representative on board from the first thing in the morning. So, you know, as far as I could tell, they may have already started their investigation. I haven't had contact with them. I don't know. The Coast Guard has the immediate authority to use dispersants for this particular area. I think it's called a Zone 1, and the only meaning of the Zone 1 is that the local Coast Guard representative has authority. So he has been preordained to be the one to make that judgment.
This morning, the Coast Guard closed the Port of Valdez when Exxon takes over responsibility to reopen the port.
Oh, no, we can't do that. That stays with the Coast Guard, yes. Yes.
Is it?
We have an expert here with us, Mr. Gordon Lindblom. He's one of the experts worldwide on the dispersant application. So I can have him get back to you.
Powder or liquid?
No.
Is it toxic?
No, it's non-toxic. It's totally non-toxic.
Wait.
I think the EPA agrees with that clearly.
I just attended an international oil spill conference in San Antonio, Texas. Dispersants were a major topic of conversation. They were also one of the main panel discussions. Another main panel discussion was open water and coastal spills. Dispersants are like joy soap. What they do is they break up the oil on the surface of the water. They make it form into little balls, droplets, and they sink. They sink the oil spill, the entire oil spill off the surface of the water. They put it down into the water column.
I don't think we would agree with that, nor would the world's experts agree with that. But what it does is it interrupts the cohesion of the oil for itself. It breaks that cohesion.
That's right.
Yes.
The droplets form and they go down into the water. The oil goes off the water surface.
No, and I'll tell you how you see that's not the case. If you take a container of oil, a clear container, and you put dispersant in and shake it up, there is no oil anywhere. You've broken the film totally.
Something happens somewhere. It's compartmentalized. There's about four different compartments here. One is, you have mass, and it cannot disappear. What it does is it becomes recompartmentalized. It goes into the air, it goes into the water column, it goes into the sediment, or it goes into the marine organisms. When you disperse, so that if you have 100% oil on one hand, you have to have 100% equal sum. It doesn't disappear. Now, what dispersants do is they put the oil down into the water column, and it makes it extremely toxic for the animals that are within the water column. This is why we're concerned about the fish. When it's on the interface, the surface, the air-water interface, it's more harmful to marine mammals or animals that go back and forth through the water column through the interface, seabirds and the marine mammal. When it goes down into the water column, it looks like it's been cleaned up, but in reality what's happening is it's being partitioned into the water column, into the marine organisms in the water column, and into the sediment. Or the tides will carry it out and it will be dispersed. I mean, that's why it's called a dispersant. The problem is, like right now with the herring fishery, fish, there have been studies done, and fish tend to avoid spilled oil. However, when it's in the water column, they can't see it, so they can't avoid it. They pick it up across their gills when they're breathing, when they're breathing the water. It enters their body, and it's partitioned in their body into the fat. That's where it goes when it's, the hydrocarbons tend to be partitioned into the fat, the lipids. This is why we're concerned about right now, because our next fishery is the herring roe fishery, which is the fish eggs, which is where these hydrocarbons are really going. So it's not out of sight, out of mind, which is what I want to point out. Even though dispersants may be applied, this doesn't mean that the problem is going to disappear. It's going to be partitioned in a different compartment.
Let me ask Alan Mackey. Alan is a PhD in with Exxon and Anchorage, and he is much more in position to answer the questions than I am. So let me turn the mic over to Alan, if you will.
Before we start, I'd like to say that I have a master's in water pollution and a PhD in sediment biology,
and I am a commercial fisherman in this area. Thank you.
I don't think we want to enter into a
on the radio. Evidently, the decision had been made for this disbursement, and I'm sure that's why there was no booning done of this vessel out there. Now, we've talked about herring. We've talked about fisheries like this. We have hundreds of millions of salmon fry at this time, which nobody has mentioned.
Which the dispersants would affect.
Leaving the streams in Prince William Sound right now, going out, and they stay in this sound, and they can be affected by this dispersement or by the spill. And nobody has mentioned that. Now, this is the production on fake salmon for next year. And the Valdez Arm and the Port of Valdez and areas where this oil is produces somewhere between 15 and 25% of the wild stocks that go out into this Prince William Sound. Now, it's a serious matter because there are literally many, many hundreds of people's livelihoods depending on this process. Now, I feel this disbursement issue was made at about 8 or 8:30 this morning because that's when it came on to the radio. I flew with Chuck LePage at 2:30 this afternoon. There wasn't even a Kleenex in the water to clean up that oil.
I don't think this is the right forum to debate the efficacy of
the... No, I'm not going to debate. I'm saying we talked about herring. There's other things involved here, such as hundreds of millions of salmon fry.
I understand your concern, and rest assured, no one's more concerned than we are. Perhaps I could tie together a few of the concerns that have arisen from some of the questions here this evening in the events that have... I'm with the Anchorage, Exxon Anchorage office, and some of us have been on site since this morning.
Governor Cooper has just entered the room and begun to speak.
To avoid the ice that was there, but of course the Coast Guard wasn't on board the vessel to make sure that the course correction they needed to do was the right one.
I thought they had a sophisticated radar and monitor the ship.
Well, I did too.
The question was, didn't the Coast Guard have a radar to monitor? And the governor said he thought so.
Last time we did a measurement, it was about 6 miles by 3 miles. Is that correct, Denny?
Yes, and Doug Lockwood from our staff just returned from another mapping flight. Doug, is that still accurate? 6 by 3.5 or so, or is it moved? Is it larger?
Probably more out, there's creeks out in the middle of the sound, is probably out as far as the mass, eight miles by probably three and a half, four miles.
Yes, sir. Again, we apologize that the questions are not audible. We're in a live conference room setting. There are about 100 people, 125 people in the ballroom of the Valdez Civic Center for this press conference. We have microphones on the podium where the speakers, and now the governor, Steve Cooper of Alaska, with Dennis Kelsey, or Kelso, his commissioner of environmental conservation, flanking
it. They're on the podium.
We can hear them. We can't hear the questions.
Who were people with expertise in cleaning up oil spills, but I can't speak for them. My impression was that that was what they had in mind. Oh. Yes, sir.
You mentioned the fact that you have a limited amount of money and resources to deal with this problem. They made the statement that they would cover this, so why can't you mobilize your people under those expense accounts?
We are, sir. We have 10 people from DEC here now, which we would do regardless of who was paying the bill. I think what the inquiry was whether we were going to put more full-time people in Valdez for DEC. Parenthetically, I want to say this, that over the last 2 years, when I've been in office, the DEC has, in fact, been increased, I think, about 20% each year. It was inadequate before. It still is, but it's getting better than it was. John?
What would you think about a special tax on oil and gas property to provide municipalities with the ability to protect themselves from incidents like this?
Do you want that kind of authority?
Yeah.
Well, sure, give it a thought. Give it some thought. Probably we're not going to decide that over here tonight, but worthy of consideration.
Thank you.
Yes. Oh, hi,
Cindy. You and your administration for addressing issues with this
issue. Well, it's important, and actually, it's a real disaster. That's what it is. And I think it's kind of ironic that it happened 25 years to the day from the Good Friday earthquake in 1964. If there are no other questions, yes, sir. Well, I spoke, I came in as soon as I could commandeer an airplane from Fairbanks, and I spoke with the DEC people and others, and then took a float plane out to the Exxon Valdez and went up the Jacob's Ladder. I hadn't done that in some years. It's a real adventure. And spent most of the rest of the afternoon on board the vessel where people had a pretty good idea of what was going on. Spoke with Coast Guard personnel, with some of the Exxon people later on, and mostly with our own DEC people who had an excellent handle on what was going on. Okay. Yes, sir.
While you are on board, did you question the delay in response and applying a boom or payment?
Again, we're
sir, I would have if there Cooper. Had been somebody on board the vessel to question. That, as I understand it, is an Alyeska responsibility. There was nobody on board from Alyeska. But as I understanding, that's Alyeska's responsibility, and the evidence is that it wasn't discharged very well. And I don't know why. Yes?
Governor,
Ice seems to have been a possible factor in this accident. When Columbia Glacier first started breaking up, there were a number of research studies done about the effect of ice on the tankers, and some of the companies were not running their tankers at night. This seems to have gone by the way as people have gotten accustomed to Columbia Glacier discharging a lot of ice. Are you going to be asking that this question of ice and moving tankers out at night might be relooked at?
Well, it's one of a whole lot of questions that are going to be asked and answered as a result of this disaster. The Coast Guard has the initial responsibility for the inquiry as to why this took place. We also are going to have an investigation. This is not going to happen again. Once is too many times. We were assured, of course, that it would never happen.
Governor, I'd like to point out, perhaps you've seen the 1988 Marine Casualty Survey study that was done.
No.
That indicated that 13% of the United States flagship tankers are involved with the transport of North Slope crude. That 13% accounts for 52% of the structural failures in this flagship fleet. I really think that we need to look into the tanker that... And, okay, go ahead.
Well, thank you. That was not, however, a factor in this particular incident. Actually, the structure was pretty good. If it hadn't been, likely it would have split in half. It was a good vessel.
My point there was, maybe once is too much, but I'm going to bet you money this won't be the last unless something's done about this. The other thing I'd like, not to complicate the matter, but I would like you to take note of something during the next few days, and that is that the oil throughput coming down the Trans-Alaska pipeline system is going to have to be slowed down for this. And one of the reasons, one of the questions you might keep back in the back of your mind is why? Because this is, the slowdown in pipeline throughput is going to cost the state, I believe, and it's also, since Alyeska supplies 24% of the United States domestic oil, this could almost be viewed as a threat to national security. Why do they have to slow the oil in the pipeline down? Could it be because they only have 18 of the required 32 crude oil storage tanks available at their facility? It's just something to keep in mind. Why do they have to slow down the pipeline throughput? I know they're not getting tankers in, but they should have enough capacity at that terminal to hold the oil. This is going to come up again because the fishermen are going to request an engineering audit of that facility. So I don't mean to complicate the issue, but I'd like you to keep it in mind.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah, one more.
The question being asked is if the oil companies won't apparently take the initiative to stockpile equipment in Valdez, can the state require the oil companies to stockpile spill response equipment in the Port Valdez area? Again, many of the questions raised tonight are by members of the Alaska commercial fishing community,
well,
and they are certainly concerned. The governor's now responding. Again, it's difficult to hear the questions that are being asked. It's a large hall, and again, there are about 125 people here in the ballroom in the Valdez Civic Center. Governor Dennis Kelsey, also DEC commissioner, is responding.
But let me answer a couple of parts of it and see if I get enough of it. There are at least two issues in there. One is, does the state have the authority to require the right kind of contingency planning, and do we have the authority to make sure it actually gets carried out? After the Cook Inlet oil spill, which was small in volume, important in impact, but small in volume, we took a very hard look at that, did a postmortem of that spill, and the governor requested legislation to correct some shortfalls in the state's authority. That legislation was enacted into law,
And as a result of that, we now have the ability to require adequate contingency plans, not only of shore-based facilities, but also of vessels, and to require that those facilities or vessels actually be able to demonstrate the capability of carrying out the plans that they've submitted to us. So now we have that authority. If we're looking at a situation such as in the harbor here, there you have a set of variables that are relatively straightforward to predict. Now, not entirely, but they're a lot easier to predict than if you have a vessel running aground or breaking up, not in port. The kind of contingency plan that you would have for normal operations or for a spill that occurs in normal operations is really a very different kind of creature than what you have to have available if you have a catastrophic spill such as this one, which was really not just a spill. We're talking about a grounding of a large vessel that then ruptured and spilled the contents in that way. So that the oil spill contingency plans are designed to deal with many kinds of spills, but are not necessarily crafted for this particular kind of event. Then the question is, how quickly can the available resources be mobilized and put into place so you minimize the effect from this kind of a situation? I think we're going to want to take a hard look at how well that mobilization occurred. As the governor mentioned, often right at the beginning of a spill is when you have the best chance of containing it, and we need to know more about what happened in this instance.
Again, there's a follow-up question to the commissioner relating to the availability of fishermen and other people in the community at the early hours of this morning to attempt a response, and the apparent reluctance of the response team led by Alyeska and the Coast Guard to accept those offers.
Well, I think that's your point about needing to get an immediate and adequate first response is a very good point. And obviously, we have some more questions to ask about that. Thank you very much.
Governor Steve Cooper is leaving the podium now, and I think that that pretty much signals the conclusion of this press conference. We'll be grabbing a few folks if we can.
If you can grab the governor or Devin to go live.
The governor and the commissioner of environmental conservation have left the podium. Exxon left a while ago. In fact, it was kind of odd. The Exxon people left about the time the governor came in. There was an attempt. There was a meeting, a response team meeting that the governor was required. That the Exxon president of Exxon Shipping, Jack Irasi, was required to attend. The questioning was fast and furious from members of primarily the fishing community. Ricky Ott from CDFU and UFA in Cordova led the questioning. There were others as well, including some of the Valdez labor force, so union representatives and such, wanting to know if local labor would be hired and if the local resources would be mobilized to deal with this situation. This has been a special presentation of KCHU Radio. We're here at the Valdez Civic Center. There was a press conference put on by the Exxon company and then sort of taken over by CDFU spokesman Ricky Ott and then passed on to Governor Cooper and Commissioner of Environmental Conservation, Dennis Kelso. We'll be standing by here. We may have be able to grab someone for a brief word, but for this moment, this is Dave Hammack reporting from the Valdez Civic Center and telling KCHU to stand by, but for the time being, take it away.
Thank you, Dave. We will be carrying any of the latest information that we can bring you right here on KCHU Valdez. Oops, we go back to the Civic Center with another update from Dave Hammack.
It was quite an event, started out with Exxon and almost taken over by Rick Yacht from CDFU, and then the baton was passed to Governor Cooper and the Commissioner of Environmental Conservation. Governor, you did spend quite a bit of time this afternoon on the vessel. Is the scene organized, chaotic? What's your impressions as to just what is being done out on the Exxon Valdez?
Well, on the Exxon Valdez, of course, at the moment, there's nothing to do. It's just sitting there. Obviously, there was a mistake made on the way out of the terminal. There was a navigation error there, and the ship became moored on a charted reef, which is pretty hard to do, I think. But nevertheless, it was done. We lost the vessel lost about 260,000 barrels of oil. The largest spill ever in the history of Alaska, one of the largest ever in the history of the world. The response was, as I said in the press conference, inadequate, and it was not timely. It should have been done quicker, and it should have been done much more efficiently by Alyeska. All the evidence points to that. Now we have oil floating on the water in a patch that's probably somewhere around 7 or 8 miles long and about 4 miles wide.
We did some quick calculations here, and they came out to about 32 square miles.
A lot of water, a lot of oil, and we're trying to figure out how to get that oil away from the shore without poisoning all the fish. You can drop chemicals on the oil and it breaks it up, sends it down to the bottom, but that chemical is toxic to marine life. So we've got a couple of real tough choices to make.
Governor, the response made several times by Exxon Shipping President Jackie Rossi to certain questions about the response, he referred to the response team and the authority of the Coast Guard or Alyeska and whatnot. Even at the just beginning to look at what has happened in response, one begins to see this incredible morass of perhaps overlapping jurisdictions.
Right.
You've got federal agencies, state agencies, various oil companies, and just within the government, department after department, all involved. Is your sense of it that the state, whether it's the governor's office or DEC, really has a big enough handle right now to wade into this bureaucratic quagmire and make sure things are being done?
Well, you know, we don't have the authority to come in and do what's necessary. By law, Alyeska has the first response. If that response is inadequate and not timely, as was the case this time, then everybody's in a mess. The Coast Guard has primary jurisdiction. The DEC has jurisdiction over certain aspects of it. It was a plan that was worked out in the U.S. Congress, and like a lot of plans worked out in the U.S. Congress, it doesn't work when the time comes, and this is what you get.
You flew down from Fairbanks today. Will you be leaving Valdez, or will you be hanging around any longer?
Well, no, I'm on my way back to Fairbanks. As soon as you let me sign off here, I've got an airplane out there waiting and a tired pilot.
I've never had a chance to keep the governor's airplane waiting before. We want to thank you for speaking with us. And as I said earlier, it's sorry that it took this event to have you back on KCHU. Any thoughts as far as what DEC's priorities will be in the next 24 or 48 hours?
Well, of course, it's pretty clear that DEC's priority is going to be to do whatever it can to keep the oil from hitting the beach. And we're going to have to use some chemicals on the oil, but we want to do it in a way that has the least possible impact on the marine environment. That's about as good as I can do at the moment.
Given the the friction happening right now in Juneau as the legislature and the governor's office try to sort out next year's budget problems, are we going to be able, do we have the reserve sufficient to respond to the situation in the way the state would like to?
Well, it's not so much money as it is requiring the responsible parties to have the ability to respond quickly. They said they did, but when the time came, the response wasn't timely and the oil got loose. That's what it amounts to. And it's really a matter of requiring people to do this in a responsible way.
Well, thank you very much, Governor Cooper. We appreciate you coming down. And that was Governor Steve Cooper speaking with us here at the Valdez Civic Center. And as the governor and his entourage head toward the door, the room definitely is clearing. And I think that will be our last report at this time from the Valdez Civic Center. We'll be signing on the air tomorrow morning at 6 o'clock instead of KCH's usual 8 o'clock leisurely Saturday morning sign-on. We'll be able to hopefully update reports on what has been happening and what will transpire overnight. Again, the Exxon shipping president, Jackie Rossi, who is here as a head of the Exxon response team, predicting that the equipment that has been mobilized around the world will be arriving in the early hours tomorrow, some 30 hours after the spill first occurred, the incident on with the Exxon Valdez. At that time, we do hope again to have an update as to what the status is. We'll have early morning flyovers. We'll try to get reports on those as well. And with that, finally, after conversations with the governor, the room is emptying. This is Dave Hammack reporting from the Valdez Civic Center and returning you to the KCHU studios.